This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, talking about intellectual humility this week. It's one thing to be a decent person, not overly arrogant or opinionated, the kind of person who listens to others and who's prepared to learn from them. But that's the low bar for intellectual humility. The higher bar comes into view when you start to think about your rock-solid convictions and the things that you know to be true. Does your intellectual humility stretch, or should it stretch, to being prepared to reconsider those? That's more of a challenging question for people of deep religious faith, for scientists perhaps, and definitely for philosophers. Well, my guest this week published a really interesting piece on the ABC's excellent Religion and Ethics website recently, and it was asking just that question, so I thought I'd get him on the show this week to talk about it. His name is Brandon Yip. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Australian Catholic University in Melbourne, and he's currently working on a research project titled Humble Knowers.
The Humble Knowers Project is this research project. The project leaders are Simon Goldstein and John Hawthorne. And what motivated the project is something like this. So if you look at most of the accounts of intellectual humility, most of these accounts cast it as this virtue that's supposed to help us to obtain knowledge. So arrogant folks are those who rush to form conclusions, or they're unwarrantedly certain about their beliefs and sources of evidence. And so most of their beliefs are unjustified and they know very little. And the story is supposed to be something like, by cultivating intellectual humility, by owning your limitations or by listening well to others, you can be in a better position to possess more knowledge. But it's still this question, right, which is that, well, once you've done all this epistemic carefulness about our beliefs to obtain knowledge, it becomes less obvious what role humility should play. So to give a kind of sciencey example to illustrate this puzzle, if I'm trying to find out if, say, the Earth will warm by 4 degrees over the next 100 years, now I need to take care about how I collect my data. I need to do a lot of empirical work to get my projections within some level of confidence. And even after that, I should not be too overconfident in my interpretation. I should be humble and take seriously the work of others who might challenge me. But it seems that once I've done all of this care, I'm in a position to know that the Earth's temperature will rise, let's say by 4 degrees over the next century. But once you've got to that stage, it's not obvious anymore what role humility has left to play. So I think it's this question of what we should do after this stage, once we've known. What does it mean to be humble then? What does humility require of those who already know things? I think there are a host of philosophical puzzles here having to do with the relationship between knowledge and inquiry, but I think there are also broader political implications as to how we should conduct ourselves in engaging with others and in public discourse.
That's such an interesting question, that question of how do you maintain intellectual humility when you are absolutely certain of something, right? Because if humility is an openness to challenge and an openness to having to reconsider your prior commitments, and we're going to be getting onto that. I'd like to get there, though, by way of a very interesting piece that you wrote recently for the ABC Religion and Ethics website, where you referred to an event that happened back in 2011. This was a dinner invitation from a Jewish student in Florida, a Shabbat dinner invitation, to another student who was a white supremacist. So an Orthodox Jew inviting a white supremacist over for dinner. What happened there, and who were these people, and why did they get together?
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting story. I mean, I kind of really use it to illustrate this distinction I make between two kinds of humility there. But so here's the story. Matthew Stevenson and Derek Black, they were both students at New College in Florida. But as you say, they're very different people. So Black was a prominent young leader in the white nationalist movement. He started his own radio program to promote aspects of his racist ideology, includes stuff like Holocaust denial, white genocide, which is this idea that whites are being wiped out in America, and also the existence of disparities of intelligence between races. So initially, Black was trying to keep the fact that he was a white nationalist hidden at New College. But I think when it finally became public knowledge, he was actually shunned by pretty much everyone, perhaps for good reason. And the first friendly gesture he received was from Stevenson, who invited him to a weekly Shabbat dinner at his apartment. And these dinners continued to be held regularly. They were actually joined by a diverse group of people, not just between the two men. There was a diverse group of people who were engaging these conversations. But it really played a huge role in engaging Black about his white nationalism. And the result of this two-year-long engagement with him was that in 2013, Black decided to publicly renounce his white nationalist beliefs. So that's the story.
And what does this story suggest to you about intellectual humility?
I really use this story in a way to illustrate that there are different, at least two different forms of humility. So Black's humility consisted in recognizing his own limitations and in his willingness to receive correction, right? it's known in the literature as self-accepting humility, right? Where it's really about recognizing and comporting yourself in accordance with your limitations. But if you think about how to describe Stevenson's humility in that case, it's a bit odd to describe it in the same way. In fact, it would be terrible if he now doubted whether the Holocaust occurred, or if he now suspected that certain races were inherently less intelligent. Rather, for Stevenson, it seems that humility involved forsaking his intellectual entitlement to engage in the process of gently and patiently engaging Black. So, I mean, this is my term, but coined the term magnanimous humility to describe that kind of humility, which I think is less talked about in the literature on intellectual humility, which is not so much about owning your limitations as it is about being willing to forego your legitimate epistemic entitlements.
Yeah, I see your point. And yet, for me, it's hard not to see this story today in 2024 through the lens of our contemporary online discourse, right, where disagreement and debate have this sort of gladiatorial quality and one person has to crush the other. And when I think about the Orthodox Jew who patiently persuaded the white nationalist to give up his racist beliefs, I'm tended to think, well, he won, right? He did crush the other guy. I mean, Matthew Stevenson didn't have to change his own beliefs. And you could say that true humility would have involved Stevenson seriously entertaining the idea that maybe the white supremacist had a point and that maybe he, as an Orthodox Jew, could learn something from this racist anti-Semite. And yet, I very much doubt that that happened. And of course, why would it happen? But does that in some way complicate this notion that both parties here displayed intellectual humility? Because it seems that only one party was truly epistemically humbled.
It really depends on what you mean by humility. So first, let me not deny that Black displayed much courageous humility. In fact, I think that what he did was really super important, was admirable. I mean, he was courageous in eventually deciding to publicly renounce his beliefs. And, well, at least in this case, it's not clear to me that Stevenson displayed self-accepting humility. As you say, he didn't really reconsider his beliefs. Now, he could be the sort of person who is careful about forming his beliefs. But I take it that it is consistent with being careful with how you form your beliefs, with eventually being certain that the Holocaust occurred. Otherwise, I mean, I think we're all in trouble if intellectual humility required us to doubt that. I think there's still a palpable sense, nonetheless, where he was willing to lower himself in order to engage with Black. And as I say, the way I gloss this kind of lowering is in terms of him being willing to kind of forsake his intellectual entitlements, the entitlements he legitimately possessed to shut down Black in conversation and to forgo having to continue to inquire along with Black as to Black's beliefs. He was willing to do all that, to come alongside him as a fellow friend, instead of, again, as I think it's important to note, as he was entitled to shut him down and refuse to engage. I think it's also important to note that all this actually came at serious personal cost to Stevenson. I mean, you might think that at the end he comes out triumphant as this, perhaps ironically, Jewish savior. But really what happened was that most of the members of the campus, I mean, this was a two-year-long process, really viewed Stevenson and many of the members of the dinner party as sympathizers or even worse, as enablers of Black and his pernicious ideology. And so there really was a palpable sense in which their social status was lowered for them to engage with Black. So I don't think that, I mean, unless we already welded to the kind of conception of humility where it involves doubting yourself, I think there's actually good reason to describe what Stevenson did as a form of humility as well.
I'm interested in your view on where our notion of humility comes from, because usually in Western philosophy, if we're looking for the roots of a philosophical virtue, we go back to the ancient world, particularly the ancient Greco-Roman world. But we don't find a lot of praise for humility there. We find Aristotle saying that honor and reputation are among the best things that one can attain for oneself. We find a sort of manly heroism at work in Roman culture. And in fact, the Latin word humilitas in the ancient Roman world signified a sort of shamefulness or degradation. So where does our modern virtue of humility come from?
So according to Aristotle, magnanimity. So magnanimity literally means the great soul. And it's the virtue of one who is supposed to be worthy of great things and demands the honor that is due to one in accord with their status. So an interesting feature of Aristotle's discussion of magnanimity is that it's not just the virtue of doing that which is in accord with your station. I mean, if you don't deserve much and you don't call attention to it, you're not magnanimous, you're just temperate. So magnanimity as a virtue, according to Aristotle, only makes sense for those who are superior in some sense. If you're great and you choose to lower yourself, as you point out, that would be seen really as a vice in the Greek and Roman world. So that's the kind of context in which I guess something like the Judeo-Christian tradition came in. And I think the Judeo-Christian kind of intrusion into this Roman world disrupted this way of thinking really in two ways. So first, I think it brought about this idea that we were all weak, frail, and even sinful creatures before a holy God. And that this is perhaps the most fundamental aspect of identity. More fundamental to identity than any other station or hierarchy is our standing before an awesome God. And the flip side of such, of this awe that is the proper recognition of God is a recognition of our lower place. And so any hierarchy among human beings is really relegated and relativized in relation to this most fundamental hierarchy between us and God. And so the importance of such a theological perspective now comes to elevate humility as a virtue, I think not just in the West, but also in Islam that shares a similar theological vision. But I think there's a second disruption to this thinking about greatness that perhaps is a lot closer to the heart of the specifically Christian tradition, where we see in the Christian tradition, we see humility prized not just as a virtue for human beings, but it's in fact something that even God can display. So God in Christ humbled himself by taking the form of a human being and dying the most humiliating death on a cross. So when folks think of the cross today, they might think of perhaps how painful it is to have nails driven into your body. But really part of the whole experience of crucifixion is shame and humiliation. I mean, one was supposed to be naked on the cross, one's genitals were publicly displayed. And if this is supposed to be an exemplification of God in his greatness, then it really forces a radical rethinking of what greatness consists in.
There's a great sort of historical irony there, isn't there, where we have humility entering Western European culture via the Judeo-Christian world, as you've described. But then even as that happened, we see Christianity in the common era becoming the religion of empire, allying itself with state power. And from there, we have the history of the Crusades and the Christian missionaries and the colonial era. So we have this sort of irony that while the teaching of Christian humility is sweeping the world, the practice of Christian expansion is rather the opposite of humble. Do you see it in that way?
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I mean, I'm neither a historian nor a political theologian, so I guess I think there are lots of important questions to be had here, but perhaps I'll just say a couple of things. I think you're absolutely right that Christians should have a deep uneasiness with being too deeply allied to state power. At the same time, I think there is a humble and self-effacing aspect to Christianity, but I think the message of Christianity itself is triumphalist and conquering. But I guess I put it in a way that subverts what it means to triumph and conquer. I mean, let me just give you one illustration of how I think things have gone wrong. So a couple of years ago, I was in Germany and I did this touristy thing of visiting a bunch of castles. And I remember displaying in one of the sections was a few royal jewels passed down as symbols of power. And among them were displays of heavily ornamented crosses made of gold and studded jewels and so on. So I don't necessarily have an objection to trying to decorate the cross, but I did think that some of these were opulent to the point of being repulsive. And I think the issue with that as a symbol, I think that might, I guess you could see that also as a symbol of what's going wrong when Christianity tries to ally itself too closely to state power, is that the cross, it's not that it's not a symbol of God's power and triumph, it is, but it is a symbol of God's power precisely because it's a rejection of earthly power. And I think to use Christianity or the cross as a tool, instrument to extend earthly power is in fact really a subversion of what Christianity is supposed to be about.
On Radio National and ABC Listen, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. I'm talking this week with Brandon Yip about intellectual humility. Brandon is a postdoctoral research fellow at Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. He's also the author of an excellent recent article on intellectual humility, and I'll give you some details about that at the end of the show. Let's talk about this in the context of philosophy, because Socrates is famously said to have claimed that all I know is that I know nothing, and everyone pays a sort of respectful lip service to that utterance, but I wonder if Socrates really meant what he said. How much intellectual humility do you find within academia these days, and within academic philosophy in particular?
Yeah, so I think it's hard to say how much or how little. I mean, I'm not sure how to quantify that. But there are many philosophers who display amazing humility. I really respect them. And there are many more that are arrogant, of course. There's still stuff to learn from arrogant philosophers. They might be really brilliant, but yeah, you can tell that they're arrogant. And perhaps let me try to answer this question by pointing to certain aspects of the practice of academic philosophy that I see as conducive to the development of, of intellectual humility and what I think is detrimental to it. First, let me start by saying something nice about the practice of academic analytic philosophy, which is that we are really rigorous in trying to apply the principle of charity in the way we engage textual sources and intellectual opponents. I think there's really a premium put in analytic philosophy in trying to give your interlocutors the best go, in formulating their claims in a way that will make best sense of their position, and really a refusal to strawman your opponents. I mean, I think this is unfair, right? Because I don't work in those areas, but it's in contrast to many other areas of the humanities where I feel like the dominant hermeneutic is something like the hermeneutics of suspicion. I barely care about the letter of the text other than to deconstruct their motives or their writing. I mean, let me just say that I don't think that exercise is always terrible, but I think it can only be successful when you first properly reconstruct what is said in the text in a way that could be recognizable by the authors themselves. So I think this skill, this rigor in really trying to be charitable to your opponents, and I think it helps the cultivation of intellectual humility in both forms. So with the nice stuff out of the way, I think there are many aspects of the practice of academic analytic philosophy that are not conducive to intellectual humility. So there's this kind of really fun quote from Robert Nozick that I've come across recently, but I'll just read it to you. So Nozick says this: the terminology of philosophical art is coercive. Arguments are powerful and best when they are knocked down. Arguments force you to a conclusion. And then Nozick asks this: why are philosophers intent on forcing others to believe things? Is that a nice way to behave towards someone? So I think he was being somewhat tongue-in-cheek here, but I think there's something here that captures much of the pulse of analytic philosophy. I think there's a certain kind of aggressiveness in the culture, a certain kind of relishing in trying to demolish your opponent's arguments and showing them up. I'm not sure if you've ever been to a philosophy Q&A after someone has presented a paper, but it usually consists in 45 minutes of everyone trying their best to take down the speaker's position. So I think the culture is kind of slowly changing to be more collaborative during question time, but you can see how such a culture doesn't really help humility. And in fact, often it's not very kind as well.
Yeah, I remember the first paper I ever gave at an academic conference, and I referenced a certain philosopher, and then after I'd finished and people were asking questions, this very supercilious professor stood up and he said that he couldn't believe that I'd cited this particular philosopher because nobody was talking about this philosopher anymore. And if I wanted to advance my academic career, I should stop using these, you know, outmoded references. And I was very sort of intimidated. It was my first ever conference. And I just said something along the lines of, oh, well, thank you for that advice. I'll take that on board. And I just wanted him to sit down and go away. But yeah. Afterwards, my PhD supervisor took me aside and he said that I really should have defended myself and I should have defended this philosopher. And he said that academia is no place for intellectual humility, right? And I've always remembered that. And of course, it's been playing on my mind as we've been having this conversation.
Yeah.
And I wonder that when it comes to professional advancement, because, you know, it's a job, there's a career ladder. And I wonder if it's possible or even a good idea to be an academic philosopher and be Socratically humble, or to sort of disavow or play down your own epistemic achievement when you're operating in this very competitive professional environment.
It's certainly possible. I mean, some people, I think, are intellectually humble in such an environment. But as you say, there are lots of pressures. I mean, just to give an example, like, I guess your supervisor told you not to be so humble. I mean, I think I was once asked, I mean, usually when I answer someone's question in question time, I usually say, okay, have I answered your question? Am I really connecting with what you're saying? And I think someone took me aside and said, you know, you never say that in question time, because you just presume that you've answered their question to the best way possible. And I mean, that's just to make yourself look good. And I guess, as you know, I mean, the other thing that came up from your anecdote as well is that there are these institutional pressures just to present yourself as giving the most novel argument. There's very little point citing people who have written like more than 50 years ago. In fact, usually more than 20 years ago, no one really cares about engaging them anymore. There might be good work there. I mean, there are one or two classics that you have to cite all the time. But really, if you want to get your paper published, you need to show how you're talking to the rest of the people who are currently alive and talking. Otherwise, because I guess they're going to be your reviewers and they want to see that, you know, I guess maybe cynically they want to see themselves cited. But this is just the way the culture is. And there's this premium put on trying to show that you've come up with a really novel point when really perhaps you're just making a small tweak to something someone has said like 100 years ago. I mean, if you present your argument that way, it's going to be hard to get published. So there are all these institutional pressures to kind of be a bit more overconfident in the way you present yourselves. And I'm not sure what the solution is, but there are these institutional pressures to discourage something like intellectual humility in the profession, that's for sure.
I wonder if you think that part of the problem for intellectual humility within philosophical circles is the fact that philosophy sometimes wants to be regarded as a kind of science. It's like there are objective truths out there and our job is to find them and present them to the world. And in that sort of environment, you can very easily come to thinking that you are closer to the truth than others. Whereas arguably, if you take a more maybe Nietzschean approach and think of philosophy and practice philosophy as more of a kind of art or a species of literature, where it's not about arriving at fixed truth, but it's about persuasion and rhetoric and good writing and good storytelling even, then you have an environment that's perhaps more congenial to intellectual humility. Does that make sense to you? And is that how you approach philosophy yourself, or do you see yourself as being more in the truth business?
I think there's some ways in which you put that which I agree with and some that I might perhaps put differently. I'm even struggling to think about what intellectual humility would mean if you don't have something like objective reality and truth in the picture. Presumably, we need some kind of standard to suggest to us that, look, unless you are humble about yourself, unless you have some kind of awe before the truth, it doesn't even make much sense to be humble. I mean, I guess you can be civil if your task is just persuasion. But I think philosophy could draw kind of its methods from a wider range of sources. I mean, to take science as a model of truth is something that is quite pervasive in analytic philosophy today. I mean, I can't remember which speaker was who came and he asked all the grad students what they thought philosophy was like. And most of them just think the model for philosophy is something like science. And perhaps let me note that paying attention to the empirical sciences is an exercise that has been quite fruitful for many parts of philosophy. I mean, in the past, you just, I guess, sat in your armchair and you thought of a bunch of thought experiments. And I think it's a lot more fruitful now when people look at empirical work and empirical data. But science is just one of among many ways of getting at truth and philosophy. And philosophy would be very much enriched if it drew from a richer range of sources, not just more diverse cultural thought, I think, but also from literature and art. I mean, I think really literature and art, so it doesn't aim at truth in the same way that philosophy aims at truth, insofar as you think that truth is kind of a feature of sentences. So it doesn't really, I mean, it's bizarre to read a novel and think how many of these sentences here are true. I mean, that's just not the way we evaluate literature. But I think that it does aim still at connecting with aspects of reality. I mean, presumably, I mean, a good novel is successful because it articulates aspects of reality that are hidden. Perhaps it explores certain questions or presents certain characters in ways that illuminate or resonate with some part of our lived experience in ways that we could not do quite without using that form. And I think I see the philosophical task as not too different in that sense. I don't think it's just a tool to spit out truths, but it's really something that's supposed to help us to see things rightly. So there's this little parable from G.K. Chesterton that I really like. So he tells this story of a boy who leaves his village to look for a giant. And as he leaves the village, he ascends this mountain and he starts to so he's at the mountaintop. He starts to look down at the village and he starts to see that certain houses now start to form into the shape of a shield and others form into a large head and eyes. And then he realizes that the village from which he left is actually now in the shape of the giant that he was seeking. So in some ways, what he was seeking was there all along, but he needed to go to this vantage point from which to see it. And I think that's something of how I conceive of philosophy. I think Wittgenstein once claimed that, you know, once philosophy is done, we leave everything just as they are. And I think that's really part of it. It's really, how do we help us to see things rightly? I mean, to kind of cite another really cliched phrase from T.S. Eliot, I mean, he says that the end of all exploring is to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. So I think I would agree with you that it's not just about spinning out truths, but I think important part of philosophy's task is also to help us to see things rightly. And I think that's something that like good literature and art helps us to do as well.
Well, Brandon, I just want to finish with this question of the extent to which intellectual humility can be seen as a disposition, something that you just innately have or you don't have, or if it's more a cultivated practice. And if it is a cultivated practice, how does one cultivate it?
Yeah, so I mean, I hope it's a cultivated practice. I mean, it'd be terrible if some people are just simply born to be humble and some and others not. And so I think there is a lot of work that's done now just looking and exploring what might encourage people to develop intellectual humility. So I think first part of the issue is that I think it's important not just to look at how individually intellectual humility is cultivated, but really to ask what are the kinds of kind of cultural and institutional pressures to adopt this or that kind of disposition. So for example, I think Tennell Porter, who did a bunch of stuff with the ABC as well, has some work showing that, you know, trying to develop certain kinds of teaching methods where the focus is not on trying to perform, but on gaining understanding, really encourages students to develop intellectual humility instead of, you know, just trying to perform at a certain test. And so I think we need to, part of the task is looking at the kinds of environments in which we engage with those who we disagree with, and asking whether those environments are really conducive to engage with them in a way that intellectual humility would require of us to. So social media, for example, to engage with someone across social media, it's pretty much the worst place to engage with someone with whom you disagree with. I mean, there's going to be pressures to virtue signal, and the person that you're talking with is going to vanish to just a bunch of talking points, right? All of which really does not encourage me to listen to them well. I think one of the remarkable things that Stevenson and others did was in really creating communal space away from some of these pressures to defend your tribe, where you could speak to and disagree without the kinds of structures that incentivize arrogance. So I'm still figuring out how that looks like, but it seems to me it's important that we need to think about how to design such forums. So having said that, I think there are certain things that one could do individually to cultivate intellectual humility. And let me just list one exercise that I think is particularly helpful. So in the op-ed, I kind of pick out this quote from Chris Watkins, this professor at Monash, whom I really like. And he says in his book that, I mean, he's addressing Christians here, but I think it's applicable to everyone who really wants to display intellectual humility. So he says that, well, Christians engaging with cultural theorists must understand not only what they are saying, these cultural theorists with whom they agree, but also why they think it is a good thing to say. Right? Until we can walk a mile in someone's shoes and see why their position is not only true, but good and beautiful to them, and until we can explain it in terms that they will be happy to own, then we have not yet come to a point of being able to critique it. So I think this is just a great exercise for anyone who wants to cultivate intellectual humility. When you disagree with someone, first ask yourself, can you state the points that they are making in terms that they would agree with? I think, but more importantly, it's not just about understanding or articulating why they are drawn to a certain position, but can you see why they see that position as beautiful or good or important? I think if we aim to do that seriously and well, I think we will at least be on the road to cultivating intellectual humility.
Brandon Yip, postdoctoral research fellow at Australian Catholic University in Melbourne. And if you enjoyed this conversation, then you'll no doubt be interested to read Brandon's essay on intellectual humility that appeared recently on the ABC Religion and Ethics website. I'll put a link to that on the Philosopher's Zone website, along with a bunch of other information. And of course, you can always hear this episode of the Philosopher's Zone again on ABC Listen, along with our extensive back catalogue of past programs. And I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company, and I hope you can join me again next week.